As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello, I'm Mark Chapman. Welcome to the Athletic Football Podcast. Coming up after the impact of Ronaldo, David Ornstein tells us Paul Pogba could now sign a new contract at Manchester United. The Champions League returns this week. I'm joined by the Athletic's Ollie Kay, who'll tell us why he believes, despite its imbalance excesses, the tournament is fantastic and there is lots to get excited about this season. Our Wolves writer, Tim Spears, joins us to assess the start of manager Bruno Lage and also to tell us about his interview with the club's owner Jeff Shee. And the Athletic's German football writer Raphael Honigstein joins us to talk about an exciting start to the Bundesliga. Well, let's start the pod with the exclusive Paul Pogba line in David Ornstein's weekly column on The Athletic. So from what you understand, David, he's leaning towards signing a new contract at United, which I'm guessing is based purely on the fact that he loved park life so much in the city this weekend and was dancing on stage and just wants more of that.
I was about to say, don't we all? But you and I don't go to things like that anymore. So
no, I may have done New Order on Friday night. That's more my era. But
now we're talking.
Even then, I just thought I'm too old. Anyhow.
So, I mean, this is really interesting, and maybe it's quite helpful for our listeners to explain a bit of the journalistic chronology as well, because I was looking into some potential stories around United coming into the weekend and while preparing the Monday column. And it was actually looking like this might go the way of him leaving as a free agent and United starting to come to terms with that, because there's been no significant progress over talks on a new deal, and the idea that he makes one more big lucrative move to a PSG or Real Madrid has been gathering quite a lot of momentum inside the industry and on the periphery as well. It hasn't worked out quite like everybody expected it to when he came back to United. But then Saturday's match came and you make more phone calls and speak to more people involved, and this sense, surprisingly to me, but perhaps not to you, was conveyed that actually he's extremely happy with the current situation, the impact of Ronaldo's return, the recruitment work that United have done aside from that this summer, Varane and Sancho. They're planning for more next summer. I think they already have their positions targeted. Whether their names are in place, I don't know. They're currently top of the league, early days. Saturday left him and a number of other United players stunned in a pleasant way. I think it really touched them. It had a profound effect on them. And I'm being told now that something as relatively small as Saturday is actually having a significant bearing on his thinking in relation to his future. This is far from being closed or almost closed, which I thought it might have been coming into the weekend. It's very much open to the extent that it may be going towards him signing a new contract. And it's certainly in a much better place than it's been at any time in the recent past. He's out of contract next summer. If and when talks resume, and we do expect them to resume, I get the feeling, as we've reported in the Monday column, that he could well extend his United stay.
I mean, you could have plenty of arguments that over the years the club have let Pogba down as much as more than Pogba has let United down. And people go, well, hang on, mate, he's paid all this money. How have they let him down? But if they don't surround him with players that can help the club win trophies, which is what he joined United for, then you could argue, well, he would think, well, I can't do it all on my own. So his mood is, and you mentioned the other sign, it's not just Ronaldo. Maybe his mood is based on the fact that he looks around that dressing room and thinks, okay, it's not all on him now.
Yeah, I'll be the first to point out it was only Newcastle. It was early in the season. It was at Old Trafford with a full crowd and the momentum of Cristiano Ronaldo. Saturday was only going to go one way, a United victory and an unbelievable atmosphere. However, we can't ignore the fact that he's playing unbelievably good football at the moment. And that's been a gradual incline in recent months, really since he came back from that long layoff through injury. You know, the assists are mind-blowing. 7 in 4 games, which is a record. The number of assists he's made in 2021 so far is unmatched. The smile, the camaraderie, the way, if you read the analytics pieces, it's not just that he's adding the cherry on the cake or a flourish. That guy is running United's midfield now. We've seen him do the same for France over the years, notably at the World Cup. And people were saying, why can't that translate to his form for Manchester United? Well, it is now. And I guess we've then got to come and move the conversation on to what offers are going to come from elsewhere. Are they going to be better than Manchester United?
Well, that's where the skeptics will come in. Then the naysayers will go, well, of course he'll be leaning towards signing a new contract because nobody else is interested.
Well, he's 28 years old, despite all of these links with Paris Saint-Germain and Real Madrid. They seem to have their priorities lined up elsewhere. You know, there's talk of Mbappe, Haaland, Real Madrid, PSG have already stocked their team pretty well. So yeah, it is valid to say, is he only leaning or in part leaning in this direction because the options just aren't there? Will those clubs be throwing the level of money at him and his agent, Mino Raiola, that they perhaps expected, certainly pre-pandemic and even maybe during the pandemic? We don't know the answer to that. I was listening to the radio earlier and one of the ex-players was saying that Saturday just struck him and reminded him how enormous United are. And I'm not a United fan, so I don't need to say this. I'm not, no apologist for them. But my God, that atmosphere, everything around it. And look, I'm not taking away from the very serious issues. You saw the plane that flew above Old Trafford before relating to the sexual assault allegations that Ronaldo has faced, denied, and US prosecutors have said that there is no case for him to answer. But it was, to those who were there, like a religious festival, like the level of adoration. His name was on the back of everybody's shirts, young and old. They were all jumping around the stadium, recreating his celebration. They arrived from hours before until hours after. You and I live in the area. There's a pub opposite my house. I wasn't at the game. The noise emanating from there, the buzz around town. I mean, this is a guy who people in my town, which is very close to where he's living, are spotting him in takeaways, picking food up. Sorry, I'm sure he wouldn't eat sort of the takeaways that you and I eat, but the buzz around this whole city, around Manchester United, the noise, the magnitude of everything that occurred on Saturday just sort of said, well, is Pogba at the best place already? And is he now coming to terms with that? And does he want to be part of this revolution rather than constantly pining for a Real Madrid or PSG? They could, of course, still happen. We don't know how these talks are going to go if and when they resume. He could sign as a free agent in the summer of 2022. He can talk to clubs freely overseas from January. So I don't want to be presumptuous, but I do have the ability to relay the current direction of travel.
So the Athletic's Ollie Kay is with us. A big Champions League article up on the Athletic this week. I find myself in this situation every year, Ollie, right? Or certainly in the last 2 or 3 years when the pots have been a bit different for the draw and a few more national champions go in pot one rather than established clubs. So I look at it and I look at the draw and I think, God, I'm really excited by this. I'm even excited by the group stage and there look some fascinating groups. And then by about match day five, I realise it's still the top two seeds in every group that will go through.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, I think you could probably look at most of the groups now and predict which two teams will go through. You know, realistically, that is the Champions League that the big clubs have created. That's the landscape that has been made to their design, and it's still not elitist enough for their liking. So they want more guaranteed games against each other. The appeal of this season is that, you know, because several of the bigger clubs didn't win the National League, Juventus, PSG, etc., it's created this situation where they are in pots lower down, and you know, Liverpool, Manchester United aren't in the top pot either. So we've got intriguing groups, really, in terms of at least the matchups. We could probably say with some degree of certainty who would go through most of the groups. But then I look at Group A: Manchester City, PSG, Leipzig, Bruges. That's a fascinating group, I think. Group B: Atletico Madrid, Liverpool, Porto, Milan. Not easy for Liverpool at all. That Barcelona, Bayern Munich, Benfica, Dynamo Kiev all together. Manchester United with Villarreal, Atalanta and Young Boys. And so it's almost because some of these teams, you know, teams like PSG, it's because they screwed up last season domestically and because Juventus finally didn't win the Italian League, that they are having tougher groups in the group stage. It means at least we've got some sort of eye-catching group game.
Well, it's Liverpool-Milan, isn't it? It's Liverpool-Milan this week. And Milan are the fourth seeds in that group.
Barcelona-Bayern on Tuesday, Liverpool-Milan Wednesday, and Inter Milan-Real Madrid. Second round of fixtures, you've got PSG v Man City, Juventus v Chelsea. I mean, this is the stuff Florentino Perez and his mates were dreaming of. You know, guaranteed matches against the big teams with very little jeopardy in most cases. That's exactly what they want. The Champions League, I think the format is great. What isn't great about it is the way the money has been and the places have been carved out over the years, and it's just created this sort of group of teams which are unbeatable, but or largely unbeatable for the smaller teams. But I would say the format itself is great, and much more than any of the domestic leagues, I think it's hard to pick a winner.
Only because, as you've sort of alluded to, most of Europe's big clubs are on a downward scale, are on a downward trajectory at the moment for a variety of reasons. Paris Saint-Germain maybe not, because they signed Messi in the summer and might feel that, you know, last year, as far as the league was concerned, was a blip. You look round Europe and all four English clubs would fancy going quite deep, wouldn't they, given how they have, I realise Liverpool haven't really spent that much money, but given how the other three in particular have strengthened this summer.
If you look back, what would it be, 3, 4, 5 years, you'd have said the semi-finalists will be three from Barcelona, Real Madrid, Juventus, Bayern, and maybe one other. It felt like those teams were really dominant and the Premier League teams weren't perhaps as strong at that point. You know, we're sometimes getting teams to the semi-finals, sometimes getting the odd team to a final, but it didn't feel like our teams were, it didn't feel like the Premier League was as strong relative to the other leagues, particularly the Liga, as it feels now. There could really be a real possibility and real opportunity for those Premier League teams, but you would also bet your bottom dollar that Barcelona, Real Madrid and Juventus would end up in the knockout stage, and providing they all avoid each other, they should still go deep in the competition. I mean, I know everybody will say Barcelona are in crisis, they're in complete meltdown, but I'll be staggered if, I mean, these things are relative when you're a big club in the super club era, aren't they? You don't fall far when you're Barcelona. You don't fall far when you're Manchester United. Arsenal seem to be having a damn good go at falling as far as they can, but, you know, they're not going to fall off a cliff, are they?
Although it will be interesting how maybe those clubs that you've just mentioned there, maybe slightly weaker in the Champions League, how that affects their domestic leagues, actually.
It already has. I mean, Juventus not winning the league in Italy and sort of scraping the a Champions League place. They're in an interesting situation, obviously back under Allegri this season, and Ronaldo's gone, and it feels like a bit of a reboot there. Bayern are obviously, you know, their dominance domestically continues. They're under new management with Nagelsmann coming in, and I feel like it's European football is it in a fascinating phase. It's largely because those clubs that have been dominant for so long have been so sort of hell-bent on world domination that they've almost sort of forgot to look after, you know, keep their own house in order. And you know, Real Madrid have, again, these things are relative, but Real Madrid seem to have let a really dominant position in European football slip. Juventus don't look like the powerhouse they were. Barcelona, we all know about, you know, their problems. So I think that, as much as the, you know, people talk about the wealth of Man City and Chelsea and PSG, but there have also been a lot of self-inflicted problems amongst those big establishment clubs and Manchester United as well. You know, Manchester United have been run poorly over the last decade. Maybe they're on the up now, and we expect them to have a good go in the Champions League for the first time since, what would it be? Since really reaching a final in 2011, they've not been a force in the Champions League at all.
It'd be interesting to see how the Champions League actually affects them Premier League-wise, these four clubs, because they're already looking like the dominant four, really. And again, I'd maybe take Liverpool slightly out of this because they haven't been as busy in the summer, but I don't think the other three can start complaining about having to balance a European schedule with a domestic schedule, given the size. I mean, you just look at the benches of those three teams in particular. I mean, they could put out two 11s.
Yeah, they could, and you're probably right to take Liverpool out of that because they're, you know, front three and goalkeeper in particular, you know, they would have, and fullbacks probably as well, you know, they would have a big drop off in those positions compared to the other teams. They don't have the strength in depth across the whole squad that Manchester United, Chelsea, Man City have, but they do have enormous qualities, as we saw at Leeds on Sunday. I mean, that was one of the best performances I've seen so far in the early weeks of the season. It was very, very impressive. Manchester United's performance against Leeds was outstanding as well. Maybe Leeds have got that knack of being hard to play against, but when you do it well, you make them look very easy to play against. Those top four, the big four, as we're probably calling them again now, which is, you know, they look ominously strong, and they look capable of balancing Champions League and Premier League in a way that probably most of them haven't done.
Ollie, thank you. Ollie's Champions League column on The Athletic right now. You can read it. Talk to you soon.
Okay, speak soon.
Good stuff.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Let's move on to Wolves next on the pod. The Athletic's Tim Spears is with us, covers the club for The Athletic. Where are Wolves at under Bruno Lage, would you say? Bearing in mind you were at Vicarage Road on Saturday when they got their first Premier League win of the season.
Yeah, good question. Well, they've made a really good start, actually, which people wouldn't have noticed at all because they were in the relegation zone with no points before the trip to Watford. But they had a really tough start to the season in terms of fixtures. They had Leicester, Spurs, Man United. And I think with a new manager coming in, people weren't expecting much from those games. But actually, supporters and the players and everyone came away really enthused from what they'd seen in those first three games. They actually outplayed all three sides for long spells, actually. They had more shots than all of them. And the stats so far, I mean, in terms of XG, Wolves are third in the table. In terms of XG against, they're fourth in the table. And in terms of shots, they're third as well. So it was a statistical anomaly that they hadn't scored.
That's what I was going to say to you, Tim, actually. After the Manchester United defeat, I think we'd had them twice on Match of the Day 2 in the first 3 weeks of the season. After the Manchester United defeat, all the stats, all their attacking stats, had them in the top five, I think, in virtually every analytic that you could come up with bar the one, bar the fact of actually putting the ball in the back of the net.
When they finally scored, and I was tallying up the shots, every single shot that went in, I was marking them off, ready for the big tweet when they finally score. And I actually laughed out loud when it was an own goal that actually broke the deadlock final. I thought it was absolutely hilarious. And then the second goal a few minutes later was a one-yard tap-in. It's classic football, really. You know, all the great football they've produced, and that's the way it finally happened.
Andy had about three goes at that.
Yeah,
for the one, I mean, the own goal didn't have a Wolves player within 2 yards of the Watford defender, and he had three goes at the tap in for the second.
Well, I saw some analysis of the own goal, and they were saying, no, the cross has come in, and the defender's got to touch it because there's a player behind waiting to score. I'm like, okay, you haven't watched much of Wolves this season because they probably wouldn't have scored anyway. So, yeah, I mean, XG's a guide, isn't it? And I guess there are concerns they could be this season's Brighton, but I doubt it because the squad's too good. And what's been really noticeable so far, Mark, is how the Wolves fans have really embraced the football that they're watching. You know, three defeats to start, but the support has been, you know, they've completely outsung their opponents in every game. It's really noticeable, you know, how much they're really getting behind Bruno Lage. And I think for all of Nuno's, you know, success after after a horrible season last season, you know, the players, the fans, the ownership, most importantly, was sort of really ready to embrace this attacking style of football, which has kind of allowed the squad off the handbrake, really. And they're really enjoying their football so far. It's good to watch.
When we spoke in the summer, there was a sort of feeling as well that, you know, a few people had left, hadn't they? And nobody was quite sure of maybe the direction that the club would go in this next stage of its Premier League life. Have things calmed down since maybe the last time we spoke? And how much is Bruno Lage down to settling everything? Or have other things taken place within the club's infrastructure just to settle things?
There are a few things that they've done in terms of staff appointments. So, you know, Nuno's backroom team brought so much to the table in terms of expertise, and Wolves' injury record was phenomenal, people may remember, which was, you know, was down to the techniques they brought in. So they have addressed that in terms of some backroom staff appointments that are club-based rather than just relying on a head coach bringing in and staff who may leave a few months later. We were all expecting, and Wolves were expecting, you know, departures this summer. And Ruben Neves, I think if maybe Xhaka had moved on and Arsenal had pinpointed Neves as the one to replace him, which was the information that we had, then he would have gone. And Traore, you know, we know there were suggestions that he may have left at the end of the window. But those things didn't happen. From what I'm told, Bruno Lage's appointment has had a lot to do with that. You know, that they were very unsettled at the end of last season, these players. I mean, it was a very underwhelming appointment. More the kind of manner of it, really, that I was hoping personally for a proper interview process with you know, whittling down to the best man. And of course it was Mendes's best man who came in, George Mendes's best man. It was a bit depressing in that way, in that there was no proper process in terms of bringing Bruno Lage in. He was just the man that had been identified, but he has made some very positive changes. I've got no idea, because obviously I'm completely in the middle of it. I've got no idea what people even know who this guy is yet. And unless Wolves do something special, I'm not sure he will kind of seep into the subconsciousness of the wider football nation. I think you'll have...
Does that suit Wolves?
Potentially, yeah, potentially. They won't mind going under the radar a bit this season, but I can certainly see people still asking who the Wolves boss is in a few months' time, potentially, you know, unless Wolves do something really, really special, because he's a very normal guy. I can't detect much of an ego in him, which is very refreshing for a football manager. And he's very different in Nuno to a lot of ways, which I think is partly behind some of the positivity maybe that Wolves have had so far this season.
You talked about other players who could have gone. You did an interview with the Wolves chairman, which is on The Athletic now. You can read it there. And his quote on selling players: "We don't sell only for money. We will sell players we feel have reached a peak or reached their ceiling at Wolves."
They've done that very well. They've tied everybody down to 5 years. That's sort of the contract length that they give players when they come in. And if you think that, you know, Wolves are going into their fourth Premier League season now, they've still got Ruben Neves, which I wouldn't have predicted at all a few years ago. They've still got Adama Traore. They've still got Raul Jimenez, who, you know, I know he's still coming back from his injury, but he could have gone beforehand. Pedro Neto as well. The only one they've sold is Diogo Jota. He's their only sort of big sale so far. And people will forget he was down to fourth choice when they sold him at the time. He dropped down the pecking order. So when they were in a Europa League quarterfinal, he was second sub that day behind Pedence, Neto and Traore. So they're very good at that. They're financially sound. They don't need to sell for money. But there has been a realignment of ambitions as far as Wolves are concerned, you know, coming from the top. When they first came in, there was talk of getting to the top in 10 years, challenging Man City and all this, which has obviously got the fans very excited. But the money that they had to invest to get Wolves to seventh 2 years in a row, and then they hit a ceiling, I think they realised that to do that again, they'll take the same amount of money again and do it all over again. So they're trying to do things organically now. There's been a real change in the last couple of years. They want the club to be self-sustainable. Whether that's possible or not, you know, we'll see. It'll be a very long-term project. And that involves massively increasing, you know, revenue streams from elsewhere. Molyneux's not very big. It'll take a lot of money to invest and expand on that. Ticket prices are up. They're venturing into fashion. And esports in particular is potentially very lucrative, but that's a massive thing for the club at the moment. They're really expanding into esports and they think that can help increase revenue streams, which can be put back into the club. So it's become a much more longer term project now than just racing to the top.
Did he feel as well about reaching the ceiling or getting to as far as they could go? Did he feel similarly with Nuno on that?
I think so. And I remember writing that at the time when Wolves finished seventh and reached the Europa League quarterfinal, that the counter-attacking style he wanted, which was very, very much defence first and safety first, would have a ceiling if they're really serious about cracking the top six. And I think they think that Bruno Lage's style, which is great to watch, has got a higher ceiling. I mean, yeah, I obviously asked Jeff Shee about Nuno. It's the first time he's sort of spoken publicly since Nuno left. He threw a Chinese proverb at me, which I wasn't expecting. He said, there are no never-ending banquets in the world. So this particular banquet had to end. And yeah, I mean, with Nuno, I think the spark had gone. They'd had a really tough year. And when I first kind of saw him at Spurs at the start of the season, I thought he looked like a different man. The weight had been lifted. He looked like he'd lost weight. He'd been at home for 5 weeks. And, you know, Wolves may have got that Nuno. He needed that break. He needed to go home. Wolves may have got the revitalised Nuno. But I think after a few years in charge, they thought a change needed to be made, and it was the end of a cycle is how that they put it. I mean, Nuno tried to do what Bruno Lage is doing now. He tried to make Wolves more attacking and failed, which I think was a big part of it as well.
There are no never-ending banquets in the world. I will use that sometime this week. I like that. I'll credit you for it, Tim. I like it. Talk to you soon.
Thanks, Mark.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
Well, let's move on next to the Bundesliga. The Athletic's German football writer Rafa Honigstein is with us now. Your piece on The Athletic today reflects that it was an exciting weekend, but not surprisingly, well, maybe surprisingly, I don't know, the same two teams dominate.
That's not a surprise in itself, but I think what was quite telling and quite striking in a way is that that we don't get these big games more often. Bayern played against Leipzig. That was always going to be a very entertaining game. Dortmund and Leverkusen, those two teams, whenever they meet over the last few years, have been fireworks, lots of high-scoring games. But the overall quality was so high, and the amount of entertainment and drama and everything that you want from domestic league football was such that it really left you wanting a lot more. And it got me thinking, why is it that we don't have more of these type of games? And ultimately, it goes back to the structural imbalances that we have in the Bundesliga, where there is Bayern, through no fault of their own, finding themselves at the very top of the food chain. And then there's a big gap, and then there's Dortmund, and there's everyone else. And you could already see that a lot of these big protagonists from the weekend will no longer be there next year. You know, Florian Wirtz, who's sort of the new Kai Havertz coming from Leverkusen, had a fantastic game. Big chance he'll move on in the summer. Moussa Diaby, French winger, had a fantastic game for Leverkusen. There's a lot of talk of him having offers for next season. Erling Haaland, who scored 2 goals. It would take a miracle for him to be at Dortmund next season. The only team that can consistently keep all their players are Bayern because of the financial power that they have. And if they pick players from other Bundesliga teams or not, it doesn't really change anything. I think from the outside looking in, there's always a perception that sort of it's Bayern's doing, that the league is not strong around them. But actually, it doesn't really matter, because if these guys that I just mentioned don't go to Bayern, they go somewhere else. Bayern stay strong, and everybody else has to constantly rebuild and find these new Haalands and Wirtzes and Havertz and so on. And I don't know if there's any way out of it, unless you really want to challenge the whole system and restructure the way the Bundesliga is run. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be enough of an appetite for it. But I think for sporting competitiveness, it's worth thinking about.
Who would have to drive that change? Where would the appetite have to come from? Is it other clubs who would start it? Is it higher than that?
I think it needs to be a groundswell movement, because the clubs themselves, I think, increasingly are seeing this as an issue. I think the clubs are quite open to taking money from outside investors, maybe not sell a majority of shares, but if you can find people who are willing to be minority investors, strategic investors, clubs like Bayern and Dortmund have done that. They find it easier, of course, to attract these type of strategic blue chip investors who want to be tied to the brand. Whereas an Augsburg, for example, or Frankfurt is much harder to attract that kind of investment. But even Bayern have said, you know, we will only sell more shares if our members allow us to do so. And until I think sort of a real, as I said, groundswell of opinion emerges from supporters saying we want the league to be run differently, it's very hard to see how change can ever happen, because the clubs themselves cannot force that change through against the will of their own members who are controlling the clubs. And right now, it still seems to be the much prevailing mood that people would rather not see the kind of competitiveness that we see, for example, in the Premier League, but still feel that strong intrinsic connection with their own club and feel it is their club rather than the club owned by a nation state, an overseas investor, or even the local billionaire. They're very reluctant to give that up, even for the benefit or supposed benefit of being more competitive. And I don't know if that will ever change.
I mean, that's a whole podcast in itself, isn't it? I mean, that is the fascinating debate to have there. Because, I mean, we talked about the Champions League earlier with Ollie Kay, that, you know, the pots are a little bit different this year because Paris Saint-Germain somehow managed not to win their league, because Real Madrid and Barcelona didn't win their league, because Juventus didn't win their league. And therefore, does the debate in Germany ever go as far as looking at, I know it's slightly unusual in France, for example, but look at other leagues and go, they are getting different winners at the moment.
It doesn't really. I mean, people are bemoaning the fact that Bayern are winning. People are sort of pointing fingers at Dortmund, saying they should be doing better with this team. And, you know, why didn't they push a bit more? And why can't Leipzig get their act together a bit more? And I think these are valid points to make. You can look at Dortmund and think, hey, oh, they've dropped far too many points last year. You could look at Leipzig saying they didn't really have a good transfer window when Timo Werner left. They lacked the goal scorer. You can pick holes, if you will, in their title challenge and say, well, if only they'd done things differently, then maybe they could have won. And Bayern, you know, this is the sad thing. Bayern have been weak by their own standards in the last 3 or 4 years. They had a manager, Niko Kovac, who didn't work. They had to change halfway through the season. They had a difficult season last year where you could see that the pressing style from Hansi Flick wasn't really working defensively, but still no one was able to challenge. But the bigger reason for that is a financial imbalance. Bayern make about, give or take, 30% more than their nearest rival, Dortmund. And then there's another big gap to everyone else. So if Bayern wants a player from the Bundesliga and he's not at Dortmund, Dortmund have found it now more easy to resist Bayern because of the growth that they've experienced. But if Bayern want any other player from the Bundesliga and that player doesn't have an offer from Spain or the Premier League, they can get the player because the player can double or treble his money. And the club might be obdurate and say, well, we're not selling to Bayern, they are our rivals or whatever. But you cannot stop that kind of financial pressure from finding, it's like water, you cannot hold that barrier when there's so much water, because the players will say, well, hold on a second. You are stopping me from making my next step up and troubling or maybe quadrupling my money. That's not going to make me happy. You can't keep me against my will here. You might do it for 1 year, but then the next year, that player will go. So until those clubs find a way to shorten the gap between themselves and Bayern, and that can only really happen artificially through the injection of extra funds that are simply not being generated organically at the moment, I don't know how that dynamic will change. I don't see who the Inter of the Bundesliga will be. You might have a one-off sort of Leicester type situation where Wolfsburg win the league in 2009 and Stuttgart have done it in 2007. But that was at a time when Bayern were much more poorly run, not nearly as efficient with the way that they used their resources. Bayern used to be very lazy in a way, just spending the money on the best players emerging from the Bundesliga, trying their hands at picking up players from South America. It didn't really work. Now that their own scouting has become much more professional, it's very, very difficult to challenge them.
What has Nagelsmann changed already at Bayern?
I don't think he's changed all that much, but I think he's trying to build on the Hansi Flick revolution, if you will. The team are very direct against Leipzig. They played a lot of counterattacks because Leipzig were so high. It was their best starting 11 as well. I think he's trying not to come across as somebody who's going to change everything. There was talk of him introducing a back three. I think the team weren't really looking forward to that so much because they are used to back four with very high fullbacks. And he hasn't really, I think, changed the overall formula that much. There was no need to be. But what he has done, I think, is brought a bit of peace and quiet, because the Hansi Flick, Hasan Salihamidžić rift was really threatening to tear the whole club apart last season. It more or less did, if you will. Now it's a much more settled environment because he's come in as an outsider almost and doesn't have all that baggage that Flick had.
Good stuff, Raf. Safe flight back.
Thank you.
And that's it then. Thanks very much for listening. To read all the articles that we've discussed today, head to theathletic.com/footballpod and you'll get a 33% discount off the price of an annual subscription. Dan Bardell and Flo Lloyd-Hughes are here tomorrow, and then I'm back on Thursday with Matt Slater with the Business of Sport podcast.
The Athletic.